a section from the Sutta Nipata, which is some of the oldest texts. In fact, I'm going to read from a portion of it called the Atthakavagga, which is considered by some scholars to be the oldest layers of the Pali Canon. It's referred to specifically in other suttas in the set of scriptures. And I'm a particular fan of it. This is a small book, and people don't use it a lot because this small book is $45. Tan Jeff has translated it. You can find a translation on the web at Access to Insight that is available for free. But I particularly like it because it includes some texts that are incredibly intimate portraits of the Buddha, or snapshots of the Buddha and his thinking. This is the Buddha speaking. This is from a time, these texts are from a time before there was a Sangha. They're very early in his teaching, before there were monks following him around. He says, "Just look at how people quarrel and fight. Let me tell you now of the kind of dismay and terror that I have felt, seeing people struggling like fish, writhing in shallow water with enmity against one another. I became afraid. At one time, I had wanted to find some place where I could take shelter, but I never saw any such place. There's nothing in this world that is solid at base and not a part of it that's changeless. I had seen them all trapped in mutual conflict, and that is why I had felt so repelled. But then I noticed something buried deep in their hearts. It was, I could just make it out, a barb. It's a barb that makes its victims run all over the place. But once it's been pulled out, all that running is finished, and so is the exhaustion that comes from it." That barb, it's interesting, it's a barb in the heart, it's not a barb in the mind. We were talking last week about tanha, and I think in some ways this is what he's pointing at. It's these built-in compulsions, the ongoing need to have our experience pleasant and to continue on more and more. And he's focusing on the tendency of this barb and this tendency to quarrel and fight for producing, well, quarrels and conflicts and violence. It's not the only ground for violence. People fight over food and resources, but people fight over views, over ideas. And the Buddha is pretty clear that fighting over views is not what he's about. The Buddha says, "Monks, I do not dispute with the world. Rather, the world disputes with me. A proponent of the Dharma does not dispute with anyone in the world." You got any disputes? What is he talking about? You know, is that just something that, you know, the Buddha in his, you know, I've seen on his lotus throne, off in the two-seater heavens, maybe, but down here. Another place in the canon, his cousin Dandapani, who is not a fan. The Buddha came from sort of a dysfunctional family. His cousin tried to kill him by pushing a boulder on him, And I gather it left a sliver of stone in his foot that was very painful. But Dandapani was also a cousin, and he was not a fan. And there's a story in the Majjhima, in the Honeyball Sutta, where Dandapani comes across the Buddha sitting out there in the forest, in the jungle, and he sort of got this sneering at it. He says, what does the holy man teach? And the Buddha says, friend, I assert and proclaim a teaching in such a way that one does not quarrel with anyone in the world, with its gods, its maras, and its brahmas. In this generation, with its recluses and brahmins, its princes and its people, in such a way that perceptions no more underlie that brahmin who abides detached from sensual pleasures. He doesn't dispute with anyone in the world. How do you do that? Is that the path we're on? Or is that just somebody else's path? And we're just going to sit and meditate. This is, and then of course when we open our eyes, Achan Jumnian, who some of you may know, who shows up here sometimes in the summer, a Thai monk. He says he has a woman in his monastery in Thailand who's particularly adept at the jhana attainments, absorption. He says the problem is that when she opens her eyes, she's cranky. It's more pleasant with the eyes closed. This is the Buddha. He says, a monk whose mind is liberated sides with none and disputes with none. He employs the speech currently used in the world without clinging, without adhering to it or clinging to it. This is not just one little passage. He's pretty clear. So if the Buddha's, we're looking here for some guidance, then the trick is to figure out what is he talking about. Clinging to views, results in quarrels. Those who have embraced a certain theory and argue over it, maintaining that that alone is the truth, you may talk with such people, but here, speaking about himself, there is no opponent to battle with you. The trick, of course, is to figure out what he's... How do you do that? What does it mean to cling to a view? When you believe a particular idea, a view, in these contexts really means an idea, an understanding, a story, a narrative. It's the map that we use to locate ourselves in our life, in the world. And I'm thinking that, this clinging, the depending on it, happens because it provides some security, some stability. If we didn't have our understandings of what's going on, we do like stability and security, even though the world is not offering it, so we sort of make it up. and we hold on tight. We don't want, without views, our experience would be uncertain. Without our ideas about what's outside this room, it would be sort of like, do you ever see was it, Beetlejuice? And he opens the door and it's some fantasy world and he goes back and like, don't want to see it. Now, without our understanding, what have we got? A onrushing stream of constantly changing experience. And so we, wow, since we first started conceptualizing, we've been building an understanding, a map of what's going on. And so the map that we've got is very deep in our own minds. And we hold to those ideas and we resist suggestions that they're not true. Now I think of, I often think of how, you know, the Inquisition put away Galileo and Giordano Bruno for thinking that the Earth went around the sun. And we're pretty righteous about that right now, you know. We know better. But we think that the speed of light is a constant, don't we? We do. I mean, it's... Although, as Lee Brazington, a friend of mine, says, you know, there's nothing that's a constant. And so it's just an assumption. I mean, it very well could be that in another increment of time, physicists and philosophers have worked it out so that they understand time as part of some, or light as part of some other system, and it's a dependent phenomenon as well. But we like our constants. You know, we like our, and we project all over the world. We project all over everything, our own wishes. Complaints, for example. Anybody got any complaints? Of any kind? Justified? Just totally irrational ones? Ones that we just indulge in because we can? Really, the world is the way it is. And our dispute with it comes from us. Byron Katie likes to say, if you argue with the way things are, you lose. But only 100% of the time. And complaints are a great marker for our own dissatisfaction. Often it's difficult, you know, we talk about dukkha a lot in this tradition, and how do we even recognize it? Complaints are a great place to look. Any complaint you've got. We were talking last week about the way the mind works with, like a moth and a flame. There's an object of attention, and then there's our relationship to it. The moth and us, when we're in the thrall of desire, for example, we just seize the flame. Everything else is dark. Just what we want. We don't even see the consequences we don't think of. You know, you just want that Lexus or whatever. We don't even think of the insurance and we don't think of the... We just want the... I guess they don't have Corinthian leather seats anymore. They used to. When we're talking about views and opinions, those things become like the flame. We can regard them as like the flame. We just see a particular thought, a particular idea, and some thoughts are pleasant and some thoughts are not. Some thoughts cause stress. We worry about whether they're true or false. The Buddha was more concerned, I think, with whether or not the particular view resulted in more suffering or not. You know, we have a a tradition of looking to precepts to guide our behavior, and one of them is about speech, and it's to not speak falsely, isn't it? But there are times when speaking falsely is appropriate and even compassionate. We can all think of situations when you take a hard line, never speak falsely, then you've got to struggle with, well, what do you do when? Often the disputes that show up are the subject matter is not so important. It's like the flame is not so important. But our compulsion in regard to it, our the nature of our relationship, our clinging to it, our dependence on it, often makes the discussion more about who's right, rather than whatever the content is. People get the views, the understandings on which their security and consistency and comfort are based or threatened, well, then you got to slug it out. There's, the old line about might makes right used to be believed that the victor in a contest would be the one that God favored, and therefore that was the right one. So that's how you had the champions. The knights would be the champion of, it's my understanding anyway. It's an old understanding. But there it is. To defend the honor of the lady, you would go out, and of course, if you were vanquished, it meant the lady's honor was not defended. Might makes right, and of course, we know that to the victors goes the history. The accounts. My rightness, my wrongness, and the standards that we use. So we may prefer to use some empirical standards, some personal validation and observation to validate our stories about the way things are. And other people may depend on revealed truth, completely different set of standards. What gives rise to this stuff? I think that last week we were talking about tanha and the four truths in the context of evolutionary biology, evolutionary necessity. I think that with this incredible processing power that we've got, that we've evolved, that enables us to solve problems and navigate this life more efficiently for survival purposes. We represent the world, our experience, in a complex conceptual map. And like a GPS, I think I mentioned the GPS last week, like a GPS, we have the map, and the map makes sense for us only if you got the little blue dot there. Otherwise, you just got a map. But how do you get to someplace? You have to know where you are. You locate yourself. And so the self becomes an evolutionary tool to help the organism survive, to make it more efficient at surviving. We think in terms of cause and effect. You hear people say, everything happens for a reason. As if that's something that's been proven. As opposed to things just happening. I mean, this life just happened to me. I don't know about you. Anybody involved in the planning of it? Was there... Now we can come up with reasons, but, And we use that kind of thinking to make ourselves more efficient survivors, to improve our chance, bhava tanha, to become in the future. and to make things pleasant for ourselves. Somebody asked last week about why would we want more than we need? Because we're built to want more and more and more and to live longer and longer. We want to live longer. We want more life. How much life do we need? We want more. It's those of our ancestors who had those kinds of inclinations were more likely to survive and pass on their genes. And of course, it's not just the 5,000-6,000 generations of humans. It's all of the evolutionary history. Every cell in our body wants to survive and reproduce. And so our brain makes snapshots, conceptualizes, and makes this map. Basic perception. Buddha described the distortions of perception that occur that lead us to suffering. And they're the obvious ones. We perceive permanence or stability in things that are inherently impermanent and unstable. There's nothing, well, it's what the Buddha said, there's nothing stable anywhere. Some things may appear more stable than others because, I mean, in my dog's life, I've always been around. So he may think I'm stable. Poor guy. So the things that change more slowly than our lives, but there's a lot that changes faster, we can see even at the subatomic level. Matter flashes into existence and disappears. All things are in process, all things in motion. You think that this is a piece of paper. It's just a snapshot of these molecules at this moment. It wasn't long ago when these were not a piece of paper, and they won't be a piece of paper for long. In geological time, that's for sure. Everything is changing. Everything is embedded in everything to the point where there really aren't any things anywhere. There's just unfolding process. To think that some things are stable when other things are not, a basic distortion of perception, the Buddha says. A distortion of view. To see things that are incapable of being satisfying as being satisfying. That's a distortion. There's nothing that's capable of providing any kind of lasting satisfaction, maybe some relief. I was driving this morning and the car in front of me was going too slow for me. Ever had that happen? And I just felt it in my body. I wanted to go faster. It's, you know, I look around and it's not going that much slower, but the lane to the left is going faster. And I managed to get some relief from that tension by accelerating into the left lane. By acting out on it, you know, pulling around the car, and no longer was feeling hung up by that driver. But, you know, thinking that there is a possibility for, well, the first noble truth. If satisfaction is an interest to you, you're going to be dissatisfied. If it's not a problem, well, I bow to you. And anatta, the perception that things have essences, something, an essence, just that they are things. You know, that there's some thing about my dog that makes him a dog. And we really believe, in essence, it's a Platonic notion. Plato talked about the world of forms that's real. What's permanent, we think, is more real than what's constantly changing. It's just sort of an assumption that we make. Buddha said, because everything is changing, there isn't anything with an essence anywhere. And the last of the distortions of perception, he said, was seeing beauty in what is inherently not beautiful. That's an interesting one. And it points at a particular kind. I think I may have talked about this last. I find myself saying the same things over and over again. Sugar is not sweet. We think of sugar as being sweet, but it's just sitting there. It's just a chemical sitting there. It's only sweet when we taste it. Sweetness has to do with our relation, our encounter with sugar. The sound of a tree falling in the forest. Sound occurs in our neurology. Other things are happening out there, vibrations of molecules in the air, but sound. Beauty is, it's a cliche, is in the eye of the beholder. To see beauty in what is inherently just itself. The Buddha says, a person's sensual pleasure is lustful intention. It's our wanting them that makes them pretty, that makes them, and that want them because they're pleasant to experience. The pretty things remain just as they are in the world, and the wise remove the desire for them. It would often suggest looking at some of those things like you would look at a royal chariot. Beautiful, but sort of like a museum piece. Not something to own or possess. Because the pretty stuff, the pleasant stuff, we want to hold on to and keep it with us so that it'll be pleasant all the time. We like that idea of permanent pleasantness. Don't we? That's sort of the idea of, I'll get enlightened, then everything will be fine. Remember, the Buddha got enlightened and his cousin tried to kill him and mashed up his foot and he wound up with, he had a bad back. Bad enough that he often had to just lie there and let, you know, have Ananda go and do the Dharma talks. So we've got this perception of the world that's kind of distorted because we see things that can provide satisfaction for us. And then there's the viewpoint, ourself, this blue dot on the GPS, the self, so that we make sense of what's going on and what we're doing. And the dot arises at the same time as the object. The self arises. It's the same. The flame and the moth, they're related. You know, the Buddha says that consciousness is the result of a duality of the object and the sense organ. It's a dependently arisen phenomenon, dependent on conditions. The self arises in relation to an object of perception, and we figure out what is our relationship to it? What's at stake here? Do I care? And we tell stories about things. Stories are useful. You know, the neuroscience people seem to think that the construction of stories do a number of different things for us. One of the things they do is they filter out the stuff that's not important. Because there's just so much stuff, so much data input, and the mind is filtering it out, you know, most of the time. But you know, you're at a party and there's a murmur of conversation and you're talking with somebody. The mind is registering everything. If somebody says your name across the room, you all of a sudden you hear it. It's because that data is coming in. Right now, you're not paying attention to the sensations on the soles of your feet. You just check them out, and they're there, right? There's feeling down there. That data is coming in all the time. We're just not attending to it. The stories help keep us focused. They provide focus like the flame. And then we have a relationship to it. And that relationship we feel physically. Some stories make us cringe. Some stories make us really sad. You know, we have reactions to stories, just to thoughts and views, our understanding. And of course, when we encounter a view that conflicts, I had a run-in with a checker at a supermarket some years ago, and I was going through a time when I was reacting to the checkers always saying, "How are you doing?" When you know it's just a routine thing, and it irked me for a while. So I was trying to come up with a response. Sylvia's response was really good once. She said, "You know, it couldn't be better, because if I could, I would." That's one day I decided I tried out. Nowadays I just say, "So far, so good." And I feel fairly comfortable with that, and they leave me alone. But this day I said, "Well, I tried out. Things seem to be looking up." And this young lady said, "Oh, good. Yeah, good. You're not one of these end-of-the-world types." I said, no. "The universe has been around for 13 billion years. We got a few more." She said, "Well, I don't think it's been around for 13 billion years." I'm in a university town, you know. I thought, well, maybe she's the holdover 18 billion year kind of person. Yeah, no, she thought it was 6,000. And 6,000. Well, I didn't do very well. She told me it was 6,000 because, she said, all of that radiocarbon dating stuff isn't as accurate as they say. I don't need to go into this. But basically, is this a ground for dispute? Yeah. But there was someone in line behind me, so I was lucky. I had to move on. Whatever provides the security and stability, the tendency to cling to views, the Buddha described as one of four asavas, taints, defilements. There are four of them, and they're very deep. Their potential, the potential to want pleasant experience, kama asava. We want our experience pleasant. We do, ongoingly. More pleasant, whatever it is. We want, right? I mean, we never cease wanting it to be pleasant. We also want to survive. Pleasant experience tends to support survival better. If we didn't care whether our body was in pain or not, it could become destroyed and we wouldn't notice or care or take care of it. So it's an evolutionary advantage to like pleasant experience. It may not bring us peace of mind because our experience isn't pleasant. The present moment is not always pleasant. Ever notice? Sit down to meditate. Be with the present moment. Oh my gosh, what's wrong here? the avijja-asava, ignorance as a tendency of mind. And it's not a tendency to not, it's not knowing something. It's intentionally looking away, not wanting to know. Not wanting to know how impermanent, how risky, how fragile our life is. And we just don't want to know. And of course, the tendency to cling to our ideas, to the maps we have made and constructed about what's going on and how we work and who we are, the way we make sense of things. So that extraneous data is filtered out, we can keep a focus, we got some stability. I mean, really, if there was, if we didn't think this was a room and we're on a floor and chairs, and I mean, what's going on in our minds, total onrushing change. Whatever you were thinking of when you walked in the door, can you even remember what that is? What was going on? Maybe. But it's just constantly changing. So we try to provide a model that gives us some stability. What some regard as the highest view, others consider to be worthless. All claim to be experts, so which one of them is right? We all claim to be, we all think we're experts. That tendency to cling to views to depend on our understanding, you know, it's pretty powerful. It's pretty embedded. And we don't notice our relationship to these views. The purpose of mindfulness, or the function of mindfulness practice, is to take in, if you were the moth, both the flame and your compulsion to fly into it. You know, sometimes all we can do is try to get a glimpse. I think I've talked about how I bought an Apple Newton some years ago. I mean, it was $700 or $800. 20 years ago. And I remember walking across the floor of the Moscone Center, heading towards the kiosk where they were selling these things, thinking, I can't believe this. I'm about to, this is what desire is like. I just want this thing. It's, you know, just to be mindful of the relationship to our thinking. Some thoughts can hardly abide. I had a practice some years ago where I would listen to nasty talk radio. In an effort to see if I could develop some equanimity. It was a particular practice. You can try it. What I did was... Now, Sylvia liked it. She thought it was... No, she has, yeah. Well, I would get off work and I'd turn the radio on, and it was a punch on and off radio, and whenever I got reactive, as soon as I got reactive, I had to turn it off. And I spent several months trying to get to the freeway with entrance with the radio still on. You know. Just because the thoughts, just some of the ideas, you know. And some people can't, you know, where's the freedom if you can't listen to that stuff without being reactive? How free are we? I mean, really, this practice is about freedom. Freedom from the compulsion to act out on, or even to suppress. You know, I could be driving behind this person saying, let go, let go, let go. That's just aversion, you know, suppress this feeling. What I did was I acted out on it. But is there a way to be free from it? To abandon the clinging? The Buddha uses the word abandon a lot. We've got this clinging and we've got the view. We've got the view, we've got the flame and our relationship to it. And the question is, not how do we live without opinions or views, because they're going to show up. It's part of the hardware is to generate those things, I think. It's just my take. It's part of the hardware to generate maps and concepts. And but how is it possible to not cling to these things, to not cling to notice and just not fall for the bait of stability and security? And how does one not dispute? How does one do that? A couple of things that have worked or been helpful for me that I'll share. First one is to not go beyond, not to recognize the difference between what I know and what I've heard about. Obama's poll numbers have gone up. Is that true? Am I making a metaphysical claim? Well, it said so on the Huffington Post, so you know it's true. This was a major issue for the Buddha. Being able to recognize for yourself. When the Kalamas asked him, the Kalamas, everybody knows the Kalama Sutta, where he shows up in town and the Kalamas say, this guy was here last week and said such and such, and he said everybody else was crazy. And we got this grove booked for next week, and this guy's coming, and I know he's going to say the same thing, so why should we believe you? And the Buddha said, of course you're uncertain. Of course you're in doubt. When there are reasons for doubt, uncertainty is born. So in this case, Kalamas, don't go by reports, by legends, by traditions. Don't go by scripture. Don't go by logical conjecture. By inference, by analogies. Don't go by agreement, through pondering views, by probability, or by the thought, this is the teacher. Doesn't leave much. But when you know for yourself that a particular action is intended for the benefit of yourself and others, go forward with it. And when you know for yourself that that action is not, then restrain the action. Gave the same advice to Rahula, his son. Contemplated action in prospect, in the midst, and after, and abandon those actions that are not for the benefit. And for the benefit, really, is we can get lost in the outcome, but we're really focused on the intention. The doctors who performed the tonsillectomy on that poor girl in Oakland months ago, their intention was not to damage her. And they may feel bad, but probably not remorse for having undertaken the surgery. You do your best. What else can you do? The Buddha had the same thing to say about when asked about karma. Mr. Gautama, there are some wanderers and priests who voice the opinion and hold the view that whatever a person experiences, pleasant or unpleasant, is caused by what was done in the past. What do you say about this? The Buddha says, some experiences are caused by bile. Some by phlegm. Some by wind. So you can tell the digestive state of life 2,500 years ago. Some by all three. Some experiences are caused by the change of seasons. Some by poor care. Some by sudden assault. And some are the fruit of one's actions. You can know for yourself how such experiences occur. Those who believe that all experiences are caused by what was done in the past surpass what they can know for themselves. Therefore, I say that those wanderers are mistaken. The standard is what you can is what you know for yourself. This is the Sabha Sutta. He says, I'll tell you about everything. What is the all? Simply, the eye and forms, the ear and sounds, nose and aromas, tongue and flavors, body and tactile sensations, the mind and thought. Anybody got anything else going? He says, this, monks, is called everything. Anyone who would say, repudiating this, I will describe something else, if questioned on what exactly might be the grounds for the statement, would be unable to explain and would be put to grief. Why? Because it's beyond their experience, beyond what they can know for themselves. So recognizing that is, I find, very helpful. Just recognizing the source. When you make a metaphysical claim about the way metaphysical, how are things? What are things like? When you make a claim, it would be better if everybody listened to everybody else. Or the earth is 7,000 years old, or 13 billion years old, or the speed of light is a constant. If you preface, I find for myself, if I preface those kinds of statements, any kind of claim like that with a I think, or my understanding is, just to relativize it some, then I wind up saying, I think this, I believe that. Where's the contention? That poor cashier can believe what she wants and she can maintain what she wants? Am I offended by the view? Do I need to be? Is it a threat? No. Maybe her view isn't a threat. This is the Buddha again. The noble one who wanders in the world liberated from views. I notice the way that's phrased. It doesn't mean without views or without an understanding, just free from them, liberated. Not clinging to them. The noble one who wanders in the world liberated from views does not grasp them and enter into arguments. As the thorny lotus rises on its stalk, unsoiled by mud and water, so the sage, speaker of peace and free from desire, is unsoiled by the world. There are no ties to him who is free from ideas. Not without ideas. In fact, he's expressing ideas. It's an idea. An idea, that word is an idea. There are no ties to him who are free from ideas. There are no delusions to him who is delivered by wisdom. It's interesting. Dogen, the Japanese Zen founder of the Soto tradition, said, "To be enlightened is to be enlightened about delusion." And to be deluded is to be deluded about enlightenment. There are no delusions to him who is delivered by wisdom. I also like the notion of being delivered by wisdom. There's a sense in some Dharma scenes that you're going to be delivered by your meditation practice. But it's the insight that the meditation provides. It's the wisdom that comes from it. It's not necessarily the meditation itself. Then he says, those who grasp ideas and views wander about annoying others. So the idea that the Buddha Dharma is a teaching that does not contend is a very bright marker for me. You know, when you look to your own complaints, contentions, disputes, there's a real clear signal of something to look at, to examine more closely, so that we can attain some freedom from the views and understandings that guide us through our lives. We use them. The Buddha says, it's actually, I'll never find it. He says, I don't say you'll find liberation through views, but you won't find them without them either. You need them to point in your direction. I do not say one attains purification by view, tradition, knowledge, virtue, or ritual, nor is it attained without them. It's only taking these factors as the means and not grasping them as ends in themselves that one so attains and consequently does not crave for re-becoming. So learning how to hold our understanding in a way that does not contend with anyone is a model that the more that I can do that, the less unpleasantness. Dukkha is unpleasant. We don't like it. But you know, if you have aversion to dukkha, just adding another layer of dukkha on top. I don't like the not liking. Oh yeah, well I don't like the not liking the not liking. Oh yeah, well. So any opinions? Any thoughts? Please. Oh, you were just stretching or were you?
No.
Oh, okay.
Going back to the Kalamas.
Uh-huh.
And the Buddha saying that what you know in yourself to be wholesome and to not harm other people.
Yeah, it's your intention. It's your intention.
So it's comforting and optimistic to feel that each individual has within him or herself that capability to make those kind of judgments.
Yeah.
But then I think of another situation where someone with their views think that getting rid of Obamacare is wholesome and wonderful and good, and they go ahead. So in the absence of people who are free of delusion and free of ignorance, we're all going to be running around acting on things that we may in the moment judge to be wholesome and creating havoc.
Well, the idea here, I think, from the Buddhist standpoint, is to free yourself from suffering. And it's sort of like free yourself first and then put the mask on the young person next to you. You know? It's sort of like on the plane. Yeah. There are sociopaths who don't care. They don't. They're without a conscience. People don't have that. There are people who don't have that reactivity, and it's a significant number. How do we live in that in the world with them? Well, the issue is how do we live with ourselves without dukkha? We can act without dukkha when we act out of compassion for the suffering of ourselves and others. Self-compassion is huge. It's really important. We often don't think of ourselves as worthy. But we can act to defend something like, or to work on behalf of something like Obamacare. It does not need to be out of anger or out of greed. You know, that blue dot, there are certain kinds of motivations that are inspired by that. Greed, ill will, aversion, cruelty, things that help us get our way. And we don't need to be constrained by them. It's something we have to practice and learn how to do. We don't have to dodge the world. In fact, we want to engage the world fully. Not engaging is a reflection of aversion, withdrawing, stepping back, cutting off. And yet we're totally engaged. We're totally immersed in this life. So what do we look to in our own experience to try to take all the unpleasantness that we add to the mix off the table? If we can take that off the table, all of a sudden everything becomes better because we just removed all the stuff that we add that makes things worse for ourselves and others. So it's possible to address Obamacare entirely as a political tool to bludgeon opponents with, or we can look at it as a tool for providing some health care to people. And I don't think the Buddha's saying not to be caring for others at all. I'm not sure whether that helps with your...
It does. I guess I was most concerned about an individual's ability to judge what is wholesome and not.
For us, we have to do that ourselves. Yeah. Really, it's about your suffering. It's your freedom. And you know, you have to take care of your freedom, and then you can show other people how to do it. Yeah.
I think the problem is that we may not recognize the power of rationalization.
Oh.
And so that we could rationalize that really the best way to help the poor is trickle down, and really believe that.
Sure.
And so if we, and I believe the mind can rationalize anything, including the Lexus.
Oh, it certainly is very tricky. So
how to recognize when you're rationalizing yourself in a position that's really not skillful, and when you are homing in on what is truly good.
Well, what's good and what's bad are opinions and views, you know? Everyone thinks their opinion is right and will engage in very skillful rationalization to demonstrate the rightness of our position. It's that rightness that we defend. It's that rightness that we fight for. It's the rightness that leads us to conflict. So the Buddha was not particularly interested in public policy. You know, he was interested in our personal freedom. Yeah.
One of the things, the challenges that I've been working on is that I found in my travels that people frequently want to discuss things with you because they want to argue, because they want to vent, and not because they want an exchange of ideas, or they even are concerned about what your ideas are and your viewpoint. And so my brother taught me a great phrase, and when people ask him what he thinks, he says, "I think a 300-pound dog is a really big dog."
Often people want to be listened to. They want to be heard, and if they're heard, the next thing is they want to be right. Want you to validate that they're right. You know, if you're making things up, for example, you need everybody to agree with you. If you say God is blue, you got the guys who are saying God is red, you know, you can't let them go on. You know, when you're making it up, you can make it up any way you want.
I am curious about the statement that about beauty, beauty in things which are inherently not beautiful, and that that's a whatever it is.
Right. So it's a distortion of perception.
When you take the example of the royal chariot and saying, "Well, that's really beautiful." Mm-hmm. What if you don't want it, and if you're—I mean, if you can just look at the trees or the flowers,
the royal chariot, but they are just what they are. When they are pleasant for us, we want them. We want more of them.
What if and we think they enjoy them without wanting more?
The enjoyment is we don't enjoy it when it's unpleasant. So the enjoyment is something that happens with pleasant experience. It's not the experience itself that's pleasant. It's not whatever's. It's our relationship to it. So an idea, for example, that's pleasant for us, Obamacare, might be anathema to someone else. It's not the idea. It's not the particular. Some people may look at lilies and say, "Oh, can't stand them," because they've got some association, maybe with a funeral that they were at when they don't. So it's unpleasant. It's not the lilies that are unpleasant, it's the reaction.
So is there a trap in saying things as beautiful?
There is a tendency to want more. To want to hold what's pleasant, what's stable, what's secure. And what the Buddha is saying is that it's not the sugar that's sweet, it's our relationship to it. Mm-hmm. It's not those smears on that canvas that are pretty, but it can evoke in us emotion that is pleasant or maybe even not. Sometimes unpleasant emotion can be instructive and we go, yes, not going there. In fact, telling stories, telling stories, the neuroscience people say one of the things about telling stories and fiction that makes them useful is it gives us a chance to try things out in our imagination without having to do them. So it tends to make us more efficient. You know? Now, some stories are pleasant, some not. Yeah.
Yeah, so you sort of have to, sometimes I think you have to decide, do you want your life to be, you know, pretty dull, with no real opinions, not enjoying beauty, or do you want to just say, well, the hell with it, I'm gonna want to go to that art show, I want to travel here, I want to do this, and yeah, sometimes there's some suffering, but it's okay. You know, I mean, because it really does. Like, does anyone else think, you know, I do think about that sometimes.
But, sure.
Yeah.
The question is whether we do have a choice.
Right. And are those the only two choices?
Yeah. We may not have a choice. It may be easy to think things are okay with just a little suffering just before the diagnosis. We may not have a choice, yeah.
But if you approach the experience with equanimity and you're okay with it being this or being that,
absolutely.
Isn't that the solution?
Equanimity is...
Yeah. You can enjoy it.
Well, that's not what you were positing, as I understood you were positing, going with the flow, which is what gets us in trouble.
Well, just more back to Mara's thing about wanting to enjoy...
I can enjoy that beautiful rose, and I know that...
The Buddha never would say not to enjoy a beautiful rose. Well, he would say...
To me, it's beautiful.
That's no problem with that. You're saying, to me, that rose is beautiful.
And I know it's impermanent, and I know...
But you're not claiming that the rose, in and of itself, metaphysically, beauty inheres in it.
Okay, but, got it, though, yeah.
Okay. That it's an essential quality of the rose that it's beautiful. Yes, I think. And there's no contention there. You know? Yeah. Yeah.
It's like, for me, in my experience, it's a balancing of how comfortable am I with how attached I am to the experience. Like, I was someplace, and I was very attached to how that experience was going to be because I had preconceptions about that experience based on everything I heard and all these wonderful things. And I was so attached to it that I ruined the experience. And that happened.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. Well, quarrels and disputes, they're a big signal for us. Pay attention.
What was the quote by your, was it Aunt Kate?
By Byron Katie?
Yeah. No. Oh, was it Byron Katie?
Byron Katie?
It was your Aunt Katie.
No, Byron, was that the one about you can argue with the way things are?
Yeah.
If you argue with the way things are, you'll lose?
Yeah.
But only 100% of the time. That's Byron Katie.
Okay.
Yeah. Byron Katie is wonderful. Check her out.
She is.
So thank you guys. I will see you next week.
Thank you.